I'd like now to welcome Jonathan Wax. He's an award-winning filmmaker, professor, and chair of the Moving Image Department at the College of Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Now, College of Santa Fe, when we say that, we are still saying it in the present tense, but not for much longer. The College of Santa Fe as a private liberal arts college is closing because of financial problems. And in the paper last week, there was a proposal that the city of Santa Fe use municipal bonds to cover the debt of the college and keep it open as an academic institution. What's going on there? How would this work?
Well, all I know is, as a member of the task force, which met last Friday, we discussed a number of options, and it seems the most compelling and likely one to work right now is for the city of Santa Fe to try to raise funds through a revenue bond, which would allow them to assume the debt and keep the college in some form open, but certainly not in the form that we've known it to be up until now. And right now, Laureate Education, Laureate Universities, which is a multi-billion dollar international education conglomerate, I know that sounds bad, but actually they're a pretty interesting and powerful and imaginative group of people who they're interested in leasing back the land to be able to create a Santa Fe arts college. So basically, I think the plan right now, and I was on the programming committee, seems to be moving towards the city taking over the land and leasing back to Laureate, and then making the balance of the land, about 25 acres of the land, available to other institutions in New Mexico to provide what they're calling a higher educational learning center. Now, these two entities would be separate, but some coordination would be necessary, both in terms of curriculum as well as in terms of marketing. The what I'm calling the Santa Fe College of the Arts would be a discrete entity, but share the campus with a conglomerate or a group of other higher ed options.
So the Santa Fe College of the Arts, as you're calling it, would that be a state institution or would it be a private institution?
Well, in the event that Laureate, for example, who are a private corporation, lease the land, essentially the Santa Fe College of the Arts would be a private for-profit institution. But they have a very successful business plan which allows them to draw a lot of students and provide quality education, and I think they would be able to provide Santa Fe with the kind of environment that I certainly have been lobbying for, and a lot of other people in the city of Santa Fe as part of Creative Santa Fe want to see happen.
Now, a revenue bond, would that cost the taxpayers any money?
Well, I mean, obviously I can't speak on behalf of the city, but my understanding thus far is that Rebecca Wurzberger and Mayor Koss and others who have been working on this, and Matthew Ortiz, who is head of the Finance Committee, are determined to do this in such a way that it wouldn't cost the taxpayer any money at all.
So it would be a municipal bond that's on the bond market like any other bond.
Exactly.
Ah, okay. So then who would manage the college? It would be this institution called Laureate.
Laureate would manage the Santa Fe College of the Arts, or whatever they decide they want to call it. The management of the Higher Education Learning Center has not been determined. I mean, there's been various ideas and so forth, but obviously some kind of management entity would have to be set up which would coordinate and manage that aspect of what it would be on the campus.
But that would allow, I mean, people have been talking about Highlands, about University of New Mexico, about the Santa Fe Community College, and in theory those institutions would have access to space on that campus that we now call the College of Santa Fe.
Right, all of the above, and probably NMSU as well, and anyone else who wanted to have a piece of that property as part of that higher ed learning center.
Which is desirable because it's in Santa Fe.
Well, it's desirable because it's in Santa Fe, and it's also, you know, now the College of Santa Fe happens to be right in the center of Santa Fe.
Right.
The plaza used to be the center, but now the College of Santa Fe's 100-acre property is pretty much plumb in the center between the developments out in the south side of Santa Fe and the rest of Santa Fe. So, yeah, who wouldn't want to be part of a learning environment that's right in the center of Santa Fe?
Now, the idea of having it be the Santa Fe College of the Arts rather than an across-the-board liberal arts institution, that, as I understand it, I mean, from my observation, being an outsider but having a lot of different people on this radio program, takes advantage of the strengths that are already there.
Yeah, well, you know, de facto, the College of Santa Fe is an art school. 80% of the students are majoring in one of the arts. The program that I run, Moving Image Arts, is the largest department with about 25 to 30% of the students. Theater, fine art, photography, contemporary music, creative writing. That constitutes most of what is the College of Santa Fe. Now, by that I mean the traditional program. In addition to that, we have a vibrant evening and weekend program which provides, you know, for working adults to go after hours to college and get a degree. But in talking about the traditional program, it is essentially an arts school right now. It just hasn't ever been marketed that way and hasn't been presented that way. And frankly, that's been part of the problem in terms of trying to attract students locally or otherwise.
It does seem like kind of a perfect confluence of what Santa Fe has to offer and what the college has to offer, because this is supposedly one of the biggest art cities in the country, even though it's a relatively small city in population.
Yeah, no question about it. I mean, you know, Santa Fe already has an international brand as a creative center, as a center of culture and the arts, and being part of that simply augments what Santa Fe means. You know, while the opera is going on, and while Spanish Market and Indian Market are going on, the College of Santa Fe should be providing supplementary classes that could be, for visitors coming to the city, part of that experience, you know.
Interesting.
You know, what do you do all day after you've walked the plaza 16 times when you're going that evening to the opera? Well, maybe you can take some classes in Verdi or Puccini or whatever.
Right.
And certainly the contemporary music department is in a position to offer that. But it's never done so very effectively.
We're talking to Jonathan Wax of the College of Santa Fe and about the future of the College of Santa Fe. Speaking of the contemporary music department, they are doing an event tonight at the Lenzic. It's one of their final presentations, and I was reading the program with Robert Knott on Friday, and it's an incredibly eclectic concert or set of concerts that they're doing.
Yeah, it looks fantastic.
So let's talk about your area, which is film and the film facilities over at the College of Santa Fe. Probably many of the listeners to this program have been to The Screen, which is a very, very good movie theater. It's a wonderful place to watch movies. What about the other facilities? I've never even been to the soundstage or whatever these amazing things are that you have over there.
Well, The Screen, you know, thanks to Brent Cleaver and his incredible talent at programming, has become really a premier theater, not only in New Mexico, but in the United States. And we're really privileged in Santa Fe to have access to that kind of programming. But Garson Studios has been pretty much a central part of the growth of the film industry in New Mexico. And Governor Richards' incentive program, we were certainly part of that, to lobby for that, and along with the huge work done by the local 480 and others in the film industry to make the industry happen here. And up until Albuquerque Studios were built, Santa Fe really was the center of what was going on in terms of film production in New Mexico. So Garson Studios has had, you know, an array of productions from No Country to Old Men to North Country to, you know, starting with City Slickers, and Billy Crystal was the first production
that
was done there.
They did that there?
Yeah, that was the first production actually that was shot there. And right now, actually, I'm in the process of closing a deal for a picture called Paul, which is being directed by Greg Mottola, who did Superbad, a movie I'm sure you've seen.
I've never seen Superbad.
Well, you know, it's got Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, and you know Nick Frost, of course, who was in Hot Fuzz and Kinky Boots. So this is a very prestigious production for us by Universal Pictures. In any case, it's going to, you know, bring home the bacon to some extent to be able to pay for some of the needs that we have right now, which are pretty desperate.
It's an interesting question when you have a most educational institutions are nonprofit in one way or another. And then you have this idea of a for-profit educational institution, which seems like there could be all sorts of conflicts of interest. But then when you talk about this overlap with the film industry, as we call it, New Mexico's burgeoning film industry, there's all sorts of opportunities for real money-making deals, which would go very well in a for-profit setting.
No, there's no question. And by the way, New Mexico is not a burgeoning film industry anymore. It is a film industry.
I know. That's what Eric Witt always tells me. I just like saying burgeoning.
Well, it is, after L.A., New York, and Vancouver, it's the next largest center for film production in North America.
Is that right?
Yeah. So we have come a long way in the last several years to build this industry. And there are all kinds of opportunities to expand. I know there's talk of another soundstage being built out on Highway 14. And certainly at the College of Santa Fe, we have the land to be able to expand Garson Studios and build more space there, you know, build a post-production facility. I've had calls from various people who are in the post-production area who would like to locate on the campus and make essentially Garson Communications Center, which houses the screen and Garson Studios in the film school, into, you know, a full-blown production facility, which would work very nicely with the New Mexico industry.
Now, when you film, I've never seen a film being filmed except people running around sometimes outside with cameras, but when you have a soundstage, are you filming as if it were outdoors, but it's indoors?
Not unless it's indoors. I mean, for example, on No Country for Old Men, they did all the motel scenes. They built three different motel rooms on the stages, and they...
They built sets to do interior scenes.
To do interiors, although on City Slickers, you may remember the scene where all the cattle stampede, and then after the stampede, they come around the tents and a bunch of cattle, and they loaded a bunch of dirt onto the floor of the stage, brought some cattle in, and they did that scene, which was an exterior scene. It was lit as an exterior scene, but it was done indoors because it's kind of hard to corral the cattle and make it look like it's in a tent village. So yeah, they do interiors, they do exteriors, but usually what they're doing is they're having what they call a cover set. So if the weather gets bad, they can take cover in the stages and keep filming.
So these stages that professional filmmakers in New Mexico's fully burgeoned film industry have access to, the students also get to use those same facilities?
That's been part of our contract from day one, which is that students are given an opportunity to do an internship on the stages. And to be honest with you, it's been a huge benefit to our students, many of whom have gone on to work in the industry and to work in different jobs and go off in some cases with production companies after they graduate. And it's been, you know, a professional experience. This is a unique situation. There is no other school that I know of in North America or anywhere else that has commercial sound stages right in the same building as a film school.
Very interesting. The New Mexico Filmmakers Intensive, that's somewhere in between. It's not the undergraduate program. You'd call it a professional program for screenwriters, producers, and directors.
Yeah. It was developed with the support of the state of New Mexico. Governor Richardson gave us $1 million towards that. And we developed that program for what we call above-the-line producers, directors, writers, to get the kind of training which could take advantage of the fact that we have all this momentum in the film industry and that local filmmakers would have the opportunity and the education to make films. And the New Mexico Filmmakers Intensive was a one-year program, professional program.
It happened for 1 year. Did it happen
more than... It happened for 2 years, actually.
Two different years,
and
okay.
It was about to launch this year, and then the mango hit the fan, and we had to shut it down. But hopefully, when the College of Santa Fe reopens as the whatever, laureate or Santa Fe College of the Arts or whatever it might be, that we'll relaunch the New Mexico Filmmakers Intensive.
Now, if this becomes Santa Fe College for the Arts, would film be the leading art form of the school?
Well, I dare say film is the leading art form of the century and last. Although that is changing too. Certainly we would look to expand into gaming. Animation is huge, visual effects is huge, you know, all aspects of graphic design, probably eventually architecture, fashion design, some of the other areas of artistic creativity that have an association with what we're already doing with theater and music and what have you. You know, I wouldn't go so far as to say that the moving image department would take the lead, but, you know, along with the other arts departments, we would take a lead.
So there's a strong contemporary music program, which we talked about a little bit. What are some of the other arts that are taught there at this point?
Well, you know, fine art is big, and we have the Ligoretta building, which is fantastic, the Marion Center for Photographic Arts, which is good too, and of course creative writing has been quite successful, the theater department, and what am I missing, I think, and contemporary music, which we've mentioned. You know, those have been basically the core of the college, but five departments can't sustain an institution that needs at least 1,000 students to be sustainable.
Right.
So you have to expand, and you have to market, and you have to get out there and recruit. You know, there are schools that have done so very successfully in the arts, and they've been quite profitable.
And then there's the Santa Fe Art Institute in those beautiful buildings by the Marion Center down on the end of the campus. And there is some interaction and intersection between the Santa Fe Art Institute and the rest of the college.
Yeah, but not enough. I've had long conversations with Diane Karp, the director, and certainly in the reincarnation of what I hope will be the Santa Fe College of the Arts, I would see the Santa Fe Art Institute playing a key role in terms of, you know, exchange of artists and perhaps students taking classes there or interning with some of the incredible artists that they bring onto the campus. You know, it's such a great resource, and the College of Santa Fe has just never taken advantage of that. And the same is true of the Santa Fe, you know, Santa Fe Institute and Site Santa Fe and Santa Fe Complex and the New Mexico, the IAIA, and, you know, all kinds of amazing facilities that there are in this area that the college has never been interactive with and should be. So I think that's a huge opportunity as well that hasn't been taken advantage of.
We're talking to Jonathan Wax, who is with the College of Santa Fe. He's a professor and chair of the Moving Image Department. We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. Okay. Marilyn? Sorry about that. The ladies at the next table were just so loud, I wanted to take a little break. Can you just fill in a... Okay, great. Or a promo or TR read, whatever, however you want to do it. So this will have been about a minute. Okay, so I'll just start now. Okay. So, Jonathan Wax, you're from South Africa, and your first film, a student documentary, won an Academy Award.
Well, in the student category, it won an Academy Award.
Yeah, but still.
Yeah.
What was it about?
It was about a shanty town outside of Cape Town called Crossroads. And at that time, which was 1979, I think, or 80, somewhere around there, the government of the time, the apartheid government, was trying to demolish these shanty towns that were growing around the city of Cape Town, because at that time it was illegal for black people to move to the city unless they had a permit to do so. It was kind of like an internal passport known as the passbook. And the women, particularly of Crossroads, stood up and said, we won't move. And they formed an organizing committee and they dug their heels in and just said, we will not go. So I went out there to do a documentary about this group of women who stood up against, you know, one of the most vicious and powerful repressive governments that the world has seen, to be honest. And they stood up and they won. They did not move, and despite the efforts of the government to move them and to demolish the community, they stood up against the government. And you know, it's interesting because in the post-apartheid era, people talk about the importance of all these incredible ANC leaders, you know, whether it be Nelson Mandela, or whether it be Thabo Mbeki, or whether it be Joshua Nkomo, or whoever. Sorry, not Joshua Nkomo, Joshua Zuma, who's current about to be the new president of South Africa. But it really was, in a very, very important way, these ordinary people on the ground, whether it was the women of Crossroads or whether it was the students in Soweto, who stood up, got shot, got beaten, and stood up against the government, while many of these guys who came, you know, jetted in afterwards from London, Moscow, New York, or whatever, who were living a pretty nice life, for some of them, and not all of them, because huge numbers of them were working in camps in Tanzania and fighting a guerrilla struggle. But many of the leaders who flew in later and took all the credit really need to give the credit to a lot of those people, like the women of Crossroads.
Very interesting. So you, a white South African filmmaker, walked in and said, "Hi, I want to film." You know, and you just met the leaders and made a film.
Well, not quite. Before I moved to Los Angeles to go to UCLA Film School, I'd been teaching political philosophy and sociology at the University of Cape Town, and a lot of the work that I was doing was really around some of these issues. So I had a lot of contacts and I knew people, and when I went back, it wasn't that difficult for me to be accepted in that community.
It's so interesting that you were teaching political philosophy in an applied and contemporary manner. That's not what most professors of political philosophy
do.
Well,
in a way, I mean, despite the paranoia and the threats and the madness that we lived with, you know, as a political scientist, one couldn't have hoped for a more exciting environment in which to, you know, to do your work.
Very interesting. So you came to the United States. Did you ever go back? And I always wonder whether somebody who becomes a very successful filmmaker, did you ever go back and teach black South Africans how to use cameras and make films or anything like that?
Well, not as such. I mean, for quite a while until the end, I went to UCLA in 77 to study film, and it was really only in 94 that the new government took over. So in those years, I wasn't exactly welcome back, but after the end of apartheid and when the ANC government was voted in, actually I spent some time at one of the film festivals in Cape Town doing classes on directing for local folks in Cape Town. But yeah, I would love to do that again, and in fact I was about to go to South Africa for 6 months starting in January on my sabbatical to go and work at the University of Cape Town and teach master classes there. But you know, with everything that happened at the College of Santa Fe, it didn't seem like a good idea to be out of town.
So you studied directing, producing, and screenwriting.
Well, the UCLA program.
This sounds like the College of Santa Fe intensive.
Yeah, it was very intensive. The UCLA graduate program really is a very comprehensive kind of program, and they try to build what they call a complete filmmaker. So all those aspects, you had to take classes in those. But my interest really was in being a director. Although when I left, the first thing I did was I produced Repo Man.
That was the first thing you did out of film school?
Yeah, it was actually. Yeah.
That is such an archetypally American film, Repo Man. I think I saw that when it came out or not too long after. Here you are from another continent. What did you bring to it was there an African sensibility that you brought to it, or did you have to leave that behind?
I didn't bring anything to it other than working with two of my friends who were at UCLA with me, Alex Cox, who was interestingly enough English and not American,
right,
and Peter McCarthy, who is from Chicago and I guess arguably American.
But certainly not Western.
No.
Or Southwestern.
No, but, you know, I guess it's the old story. I mean, the film that I made after that, which was Power Highway, which I directed, was a story about Native Americans, and I'm neither Native nor American.
Right.
You know, it's the old argument about do you have to be from within the culture to make a film that resonates for the people in that culture? And my answer to that is absolutely not. In fact, I think it's an advantage to be outside of the culture in some ways.
Really?
Yeah, I do, yeah. I do. I mean, I think in a lot of cases, people from outside of the culture, and you know, I think of people like Michael Apted from England, and there are a lot of filmmakers who have come to this country and really made distinctive films because they can step back a little bit and bring a kind of a somewhere between a freshness and almost a sense of awe about what it is to be in America. That, you know, I think if you live inside the culture, a lot of times you kind of take for granted.
Or don't even see in the first place.
Perhaps, yeah.
So you made a bunch of films as director and producer as well, and you also more recently have been writing screenplays, is that correct?
Yeah.
Tell us
more
about that.
Well, when I took the job at the College of Santa Fe, it became increasingly difficult to leave and go and work as a director, so I turned my spare time to screenwriting.
Which you can do in any coffee shop.
Oh, yeah, particularly this one. the most recent screenplay I did, which is called Cold Sleep Lullaby, is an adaptation of a book by Andrew Brown. And it's set actually in Stellenbosch, which is the wine country in South Africa. It's sort of what the French would call a policier. I guess we would call it a thriller. It's about a cop in South Africa after the end of the apartheid regime, and he has to take on a case that he really doesn't want to take on. He's sort of the reluctant hero, but he was sort of on the wrong side of history as a cop during the apartheid era, even though he's black, or maybe because he's black, I don't know. And part of the process of him solving this case is also him finding redemption for himself in his own eyes as well as in the eyes of one of his fellow cops.
So is this going to be made?
Well, I'm hoping, I have a contract to direct it.
I want to see it, just in that description. I want to see it.
Well, thank you. We're trying to get the money together right now and hopefully soon.
This is always the question that people who, and I know a number of people who are writing screenplays or have written screenplays or wrote a novel that wants to be adapted to a screenplay or whatever, is, do you have any creative control over it? I mean, even if you manage to sell it, most screenplays don't get made.
Right.
So do you, like, here's this thriller policiel that you wrote. Do you, have to make your own production company if you want to make sure that it really gets made?
Well, hopefully some other production company, like a studio, would say, we'd like to fund this, and then you don't have to deal with that aspect, which is always a bore. But sometimes, you know, like in the case of Pow Wow, in the case of Repo Man, we went out and formed a company and tried to get someone to invest in the company. And so, you know, it's by all and any means necessary is what the process of getting a film made is. It's an incredibly difficult kind of alchemy that you have to put together to get to the final result.
Is there a South African film industry to speak of?
There is a huge South African film industry, but the South African film industry has exactly the same problem that the New Mexican film industry has, which is it has become a service industry for Hollywood. And that's great from an economic development point of view because it brings a lot of business and money to the place, but it's left a big hole in terms of local filmmakers making their own films. Having said that, there are filmmakers there who are working, and a few feature films get made every year, and obviously television for the local market gets made. But there is an interest in this project, and I think that, and maybe a co-production with the Canadians, with the Brits, and maybe an American company, we can put this together.
You've mentioned that, I mean, as a director, it's virtually impossible to both direct movies and be a college professor. But if a project like this happens, you could kind of juggle it.
Yeah, if a project like this or any other project that I've been trying to get made, like Another Year in Africa or any of my other screenplays, I would take a leave of absence and I'd go and do it.
When you say the New Mexican film industry and the South African film industry are basically, how'd you put it, outposts for Hollywood film industry, what does New Mexico's film industry need in order to grow to its next phase?
You mean to develop a local industry?
Of its own, yeah.
Not
to be totally in the shadow of Hollywood, or maybe it always will be.
Well, we have a very good example already in place, which is the Visions New Mexico program, where the government provides up to $10,000 for local filmmakers to make shorts. If that program were expanded, where there was a rolling fund of, say, $10 million to make movies in the realm of somewhere between $500,000 and $2 million, you could make feature films and replenish the fund if the movies make any money, and if not, they have an economic impact, like bringing films from outside of New Mexico have on our economy. So it's sort of a win-win situation, and I think that's the way you build an industry.
When a movie, this is a very naive question, but I don't know the answer, and that means probably nobody else who's listening does either. When a movie costs $100 million, where does that money go?
Well,
is it mostly the big-name actors?
Yeah, I mean, right now the big-name actors are taking $25 million up front as a fee. You know, big-name directors are taking anywhere from $5 to $10 million, if not more, as a fee. You know, visual effects and CGI and all that have become quite expensive to deliver at the level that
CGI being computer graphics.
Yeah, like, you know, T4 or whatever was just shot in Albuquerque, and I believe that had a $200 million budget. Yeah, I mean, these are huge frame-by-frame expenses that have to go down. But in a a visual effects heavy type of film, in a regular dramatic film, you know, if you put Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie in there, you know, be ready to put up $50 million just for their fees, let alone for their massage therapist, their nutritionist, their dog trainer, whatever, that they need to have to get the movie going. And then, of course, the cost of making the movie. So, you know, a low-budget movie today in Hollywood is, in the studio system, is somewhere around about $25 million. An average budget is somewhere around about $60 million.
Now, considering the fact that there are dazzlingly talented actors that nobody's ever heard of, and there are very good plots that don't contain car chases or special effects, what is a reasonable budget to make a movie with lesser-known actors and you know, high production values that don't contain all those fancy things?
Look, you can do an incredible movie for under $1 million. You know, you can find good actors and good crew and what have you. My friend Alex Cox, who directed Repo Man, did a film last year called Searchers 2.0.
Searchers 2.0. That was a really good movie. I interviewed him about that when it was at the film center.
Yeah, and Alex used no-name actors.
Who were amazing.
Who had actually been in Repo Man with no-name men and no-name now. And he didn't take much of a fee. And the movie was done for $200,000. You know, it was done on high-def video, and it's fine. You certainly can do that. But the name of the game is still distribution. The problem is to get the movie out there. And if you don't have anything to sell in terms of marquee, big names, you know, that people draw people in, it becomes very hard to sell unless you have an incredibly successful film from a critical point of view. If you go and win the Palme d'Or at Cannes or the Filmmakers Trophy at Sundance, you have a shot at getting critics to review you, and then maybe the film will be seen in the likes of the Screen and the CCA and the Lumley in Los Angeles and the Nickelodeon in Boston and these kind of theaters.
Right. I mean, I think part of an educational process that would be really nice to see is educating the public to watch movies for their own sake and not for their star value.
That would be nice. But it's the same in the publishing industry. I mean, you know, I saw Jhumpa Lahiri the other night.
Right, at the Lanham.
Yeah, who's fantastic. And, you know, and I look forward to reading her new book. But she ain't going to sell the kind of numbers that that, you know, Dean Koontz or whoever will sell. And it's the same in the film business. There's works of art and that we all want to see, the likes of you and I, but they don't make much money. They have to be done, you know, on a modest budget to be able to recoup anything. And then they're mass market fare. You know, it's like Geronimo versus the restaurant I'm talking about versus McDonald's. It's a different kind of experience, but they both call themselves restaurants.
Right, right. And one of them is a whole lot more nutritious than the other.
Yeah, McDonald's is very nutritious.
In some ways. All right, we're talking to Jonathan Wax. So we've just got a couple of minutes left, and this is probably just ridiculous, but what are your favorite films?
Oh, Chinatown, Casablanca, Repo Man.
Have to put your own in there. When a filmmaker like you or whoever has a favorite film or a couple of favorite films that they've just watched over and over again, those may or may not be the films that are most influential on your own work. Are those two, Casablanca and Chinatown, would you say?
No. Actually, what got me interested in being a filmmaker was Bertolucci's Conformist.
Oh, my goodness. That's an unbelievable movie.
Well, it is because, you know, my interest at the time as a political scientist and somebody who started out as a documentary filmmaker was to really be doing something that was meaningful from a political and social point of view. And when I saw that film, I went, wow, you know, this really is a film that manages to combine the political and the aesthetic in a very powerful way.
And the very deeply personal.
Yeah, exactly. And it's told as a personal story, but it's immensely political. And in a way, so is Chinatown. I mean,
right.
And so is Casablanca, funnily enough.
Right, right.
So those films do manage to tell those stories in a compelling way, but, you know, through an individual's own personal story, but have an amazing political impact as well.
So we started off this conversation talking about the fate of the College of Santa Fe and this idea that the city council approved the idea of putting out revenue bonds to basically assume the expenses of the college so that it can survive as an arts college called Santa Fe College of the Arts or something along those lines. If people are interested in the College of Santa Fe, what should they do? I mean, is this a good time for people to call their city councilors or email them?
It never hurts. I mean, my sense of it is that the councilors are pretty well aware of what the issues are at this point. I mean, if anybody's got any money and want to send a check to the city council to assist in the process, I'm sure that would be welcome. I don't mean that entirely
facetiously. For a few gajillion dollars?
Well, you know, it's a $35 million burden, which, you know, if you buy the revenue bonds, it'll go faster. I'm not sure what the answer to that question is, but, you know, I think the important thing is for people to, you know, I don't want to sound like Jesse Jackson or Barack Obama, but why not? I mean, you know, is to keep hope alive.
Right.
And that's what the students have been just incredible, as have the faculty and staff at the college. You know, in the face of the most miserable and depressing and toxic environment that has existed over the last 6 months at the college, people have still believe that in some form or another, something better and something exciting is going to emerge from the ashes of this institution, and I believe it will.
Well, I certainly hope that is true. We've had some very talented students from different departments on and professors at different times on this program, and we hope that continues. Jonathan Wax is professor and chair of the Moving Image Arts Department at the College of Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks so much to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, The Colors of Jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.